Simcha Dinitz was a close associate and personal friend of Golda Meir for many years. He describes the time he first began working for her.
It was 1963 when I was working at the Foreign Ministry in the office of the Director General. At that time, the Chief of Personnel of the Foreign Office approached me and said that Mrs. Meir was looking for a director of her office because the previous one was going on foreign assignment. And I was one of the candidates for the interview. I was rather shocked because I didn't expect it and because I was quite satisfied and happy with the job I was doing with the Director General. And frankly speaking, I was a little scared because I didn't know her personally and she had the reputation of being a very formidable person. I had not contacted her and I was not very much at ease about it. I was ordered to come for the interview and I came. When I came to the interview, I found her in her office reading some papers, and she took off her glasses, looked at me and said, "Why do you want the job?" I looked at her back and said, "I really don't want it." And she said, "You don't? Why?" I explained to her that I was doing this job with the Director General, and it was quite happy with it, and the job was quite good, and I was frankly scared of the new job. "You don't like the job? That makes two of us," she said. "I don't like the job either." And she told me of the great affection she had in working in the Ministry of Labor. And now she hated to leave that job because that was a job where we can affect things by our own doing, while the Foreign Ministry, in the Foreign Ministry, we are dependent on what others want us to do. "And by the end of the day, you have pushed," she said, "a number of papers from one side of the desk to another, but you don't have the feeling that you have created something new, that you have built a new road, created a new bridge, built a new housing for the new immigrants." So all these things were associated in her eyes with the Ministry of Labor. Well, to make a long story short, about 2 weeks after the interview, I was called and told that I was accepted for the job. And that is the way I started working for Golda Meir. However, I would like to get back to 1956, when Golda Meir became Israel's second foreign minister. At that time, the Fedayeen terrorist raids were reaching further into Israel. And in July, Egyptian President Nasser seized the Suez Canal. The tension culminated in the Sinai campaign, in which Israeli forces captured the entire Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip in less than 100 hours. The Egyptian army had been thoroughly defeated. The war then moved into the diplomatic arena, the United Nations. It demanded that Israel withdraw completely from the captured territories. On December 5, 1956, Golda forcefully spoke before the General Assembly.
"For 8 years now, Israel has been subjected to the unremitting violence of physical assault and to an equally unremitting intent to destroy our country economically through blockade, through boycott, and through lawless interference with the development of our natural resources. Since Israel's efforts to repulse the concerted Arab onslaught in 1948, my country has had no respite from hostile acts and loudly proclaimed threats of destruction. 'Twould be idle to pretend that the present situation can be discussed without regard to this background, or that the causes that precipitated Israel's recent security action can be ignored. If this assembly is genuinely determined to restore peace to the Middle East, it must first determine from which source aggressive policies derive. It will serve little purpose to isolate one link in the chain of circumstances, to thrust the weight of resolutions upon one incident without considering the total effect. Unless the United Nations is prepared to use its influence to prevail upon the countries of the Middle East to negotiate a fundamental solution, the Middle Eastern cauldron will continue to seethe, and the region will be a powder keg for others anxious to exploit its inflammable possibilities. Not only the well-being of Israel, but perhaps the peace of mankind, demand that the question of responsibility for unrest in this part of the world be squarely faced and the causes of tension removed."
Golda addresses an issue, the refugee problem, that has remained throughout the years. She logically explains, at the same General Assembly meeting, how other countries have solved their refugee problem.
Mr. President, the practical problems which it is claimed divide the Arabs and Israel are not beyond solution. The world has, for instance, known and still knows refugee problems of far wider scope than those of the Arab refugees. In Korea, in India and Pakistan, in Greece and Turkey, in Europe after World War II, these numerically far larger problems have or are being successfully handled. Who more than the Jewish people has endured the tragic fate of the refugee? If today there is no bitter Jewish refugee problem in the world, it is because Israel, supported by the solidarity of the Jewish people everywhere and with the aid of friendly governments, has largely solved it. There need never have been a Palestine Arab refugee problem at all had it not been created by the action of the Arab states. Given the cooperation of those same Arab states, this distressing human problem could readily have been solved and can be solved today. In its solution, Israel, as has been previously stated on behalf of my government, is prepared to play its part. But while Israel was absorbing Jewish refugees to a number exceeding that of all the Arab refugees, and hundreds of thousands of those whom we absorbed came from these same Arab lands, the Arab states, for their part, with the exception of Jordan, were erecting an iron wall between themselves and these kinsmen of theirs. And since then, they have lost no opportunity for exploiting these people as a political weapon in their war against Israel.
President Eisenhower and Secretary Dulles led the U.S. policy in forcing Israel to withdraw from the Sinai and the Gaza, allowing the Egyptian army to return to those areas. In October of 57, Golda returned to the United Nations to make another appeal for peace and to express Israel's determination to survive.
I should like from this rostrum to address to the Arab states of the Middle East a solemn appeal. Israel is approaching her 10th anniversary. You did not want it to be born. You fought against the decision of the United Nations. You then attacked us by military force. We have all been witnesses to sorrow, destruction, and the spilling of blood and tears. Yet Israel is here, growing, developing, progressing. It has gained many friends, and their number is steadily increasing. We are an old, tenacious people, and as our history has proved, not easily destroyed. Like you, the Arab countries, we have regained our national independence, and as with you, so with us, nothing will cause us to give it up. We are here to stay. History has decreed that the Middle East consists of an independent Israel and independent Arab states. This verdict will never be reversed. In the light of these facts, what is the use or realism or the justice of policies and attitudes based on the fiction that Israel is not there or will somehow disappear? Would it not be better for all to build a future for the Middle East based on cooperation? Israel will exist and flourish even without peace. But surely, a future of peace would be better both for Israel and for her neighbors. The Arab world, with its 10 sovereignties and over 3 million square miles, can well afford to accommodate itself to peaceful cooperation with Israel. Does hate for Israel and the aspiration for its destruction make one child in your countries happier? Does it convert one hovel into a house? Does culture thrive on the soil of hatred? We have not the slightest doubt that eventually there will be peace and cooperation between us. This is an historic necessity for both people. We are prepared, we are anxious to bring it about now.
The State of Israel has a special meaning for Jews all over the world. Probably no one ever expressed that meaning as well as Golda did. In a speech given for Israel Bonds in March 1973, Golda expressed her feelings that the State of Israel was more than simply a beginning for Jews. She saw Israel as the culmination of all that had come before in Jewish history, of all the sadness, all the longing, and all the hope.
Several years ago, as Minister for Foreign Affairs, I went on an official visit to Peru. The people in Peru were very, very kind to me. And one of the occasions was given the citizenship of their capital, of Lima. On my way to receive this citation, I visited a little street that in the days of the Inquisition was called Kill the Jews. Now it's called the Jewish Street. Those of you who have been in Latin America know that usually in the capitals there's a large square, a round square, a large center there, and around it are all the important buildings, the municipality, the church, and many other important buildings. This street, the Jewish Street, which was formerly Kill the Jews Street, ends on this circle. On this corner, there's an old building, and I went through it. There is the court, intact as it was in olden days. There is the place where the Jew who was up on trial for being a Jew, that he sat. On the other side sat the one that accused him of it. There were benches for the audience. There was the table for the judges. And then we went down into the cellar, and there were still the cells of the Jew who was thrown into the cell before he was burned to death in the center of this great big circle. And from there, I went to the municipality. Originally, I should have spoken in English. After being through this building, I decided I'm coming to this building now not only as a member of the cabinet of the State of Israel, but I represent all those who were in the cells and who were burned at the Inquisition, all those who are not more, all those who went to their death because they insisted on being Jews and would not change. They were inflexible and intransigent already in the old ages, and I thought I represented them. And I couldn't represent them speaking English. I could represent them only in the Hebrew tongue.
With Yerushalayim ours, no more Dachau's papillars. At the wall we do not dwell. At Entebbe's we don't fail. At Masada we won't die. We say Am Yisrael.
Fortunately, Arab hostility wasn't the only issue during her term as foreign minister. In 1958, Golda traveled to several newly independent countries to meet with the heads of state. The trip was more than a goodwill gesture. It laid the groundwork for what became the International Cooperation Program, through which thousands of Israeli experts in medicine, agriculture, engineering, and many other fields worked with Africans to improve conditions in their countries. The program also brought many Africans to Israel to participate in training in those same fields. Golda's strong feelings about the programs are read from her autobiography by Marion Seldes.
I am prouder of Israel's international cooperation program and of the technical aid we gave to the people of Africa than I am of any other single project we have ever undertaken. For me, more than anything else, that program typifies the drive towards social justice, reconstruction, and rehabilitation that is at the very heart of labor Zionism and Judaism. The philosophy of life that impelled the men and women of Mojave in the 1920s to dedicate themselves to pioneering within a cooperative framework that led my daughter and her comrades to continue in that same demanding pattern in the Revivim of the 1940s, and that is responsible today for each new kibbutz established in Israel, is identical, I believe, with the vision that took Israelis into African countries for years to share with the Africans the practical and theoretical knowledge that alone could answer Africa's needs in a changing world in which it was at last responsible for its own destiny. Not that all those who took part in the sharing of our national experience with the Africans were socialists. Far from it. But for me, at least, the program was a logical extension of principles in which I have always believed, in principles, in fact, which gave a real purpose to my life. So, of course, I never can regard any facet of that program as having been in vain. And equally, I cannot believe that any of the Africans who were involved in it or reaped its fruits will ever regard it in that light either. One other thing. We shared with the Africans not only the challenge posed by the need for rapid development, but also the memory of centuries of suffering, oppression, discrimination, slavery. These are not just catchwords for Jews or for Africans. They refer not to experiences undergone hundreds of years ago by half-forgotten ancestors, but to torment and degradation experienced only yesterday.
Golda's sister, Clara Stern, recalls an anecdote relating to Africa.
Many of the people in Africa to this day remember Golda. While I was in Israel, a mother from Ghana wrote telling her that she had named her boy Mr. Golda Meir. There are about 50 youngsters in Africa named after Golda.
In the early 1960s, Golda traveled to various nations in Asia, Europe, Africa, and Latin America. That travel and the general stress of the job as foreign minister took its toll. However, Golda was hardly a young woman. She was 65 years old in 1963 and was frequently ill during those years. In 1965, she announced her retirement from government. Golda was not a member of the government during the spectacular Israeli victory in the Six-Day War in 1967. But on the last days of the war, she flew to New York City to speak at the United Jewish Appeals rally at Madison Square Garden. It was a packed house, and the applause was deafening. Israel had won the third war it had to fight since becoming a nation. Golda gave the background of this third war.
If we had 10 years of relative peace, only incidents on the border, only boys of the Almagor kibbutz killed, only the railroad near Beersheba mined, only pipes that were destroyed, only cars that went on mines, if only this happened for 10 years. It was also because Nasser kept saying over and over again, certainly I will attack Israel, but I am not strong enough. This time he made his big mistake. He thought he was strong enough. He counted strength merely in numbers of people, numbers of tanks, numbers of planes, and he thought now he is strong enough. He forgot one single element, the spirit of a small people whose only alternative to winning the war is the sea, the Mediterranean Ocean. And this people, our boys fought not for territorial expansion. They were not sent to battle as the Egyptian soldiers were sent in a holy war to destroy, to kill, to annihilate. They were sent to battle so that people should live. They were sent to battle by a government who they know was prepared, is prepared at any moment for peace and cooperation with its neighbors and peace with the entire world. But for weeks, the Sinai Desert, that we were forced to evacuate in 1957, was filled with tens of thousands of Egyptian soldiers, with over 1,000 tanks, with guns and ammunition, near the Gaza Strip, which we were promised that if we leave Gaza, never will Egyptian soldiers enter Gaza. And they did several hours after we were forced to leave Gaza. The Sharm el-Sheikh, the waterway to Eilat, was closed. And this was after the family of nations promised together, especially with all the maritime countries, that this waterway will be free passage also for Israel vessels. When Nasser decided it was closed, it remained closed. My friends, we know that we have good friends in the world. You are privileged to live in a country who's considered by us one of our greatest friends that Israel has. We have other friends as well. And yet, we had to go it alone. We didn't want anybody to go to war for us. We didn't want anybody else to lay down his life for us. We didn't want one drop of blood spilled by somebody else for our freedom and for our survival. But there we sat, day after day, more than 2 weeks, with all this dangerous apparatus of killing and destruction massed on our border. We were hoping against hope. Maybe this time something will be done by all the powers in order to avoid this battle. Until last Monday morning, it seems as though it was years ago. Last Monday morning, finally, Nasser's soldiers began to move in our direction. His planes began to fly towards Israel. Thank God that it wasn't our airfields that were knocked out first, but that our Air Force was quick enough and effective enough in the first few hours to knock out the airfields and the planes in the airfields.
One of the holiest places in Judaism is the Western Wall of the Second Temple, which was destroyed in year 70 AD by the Romans. The Jews were promised access to this and all other sacred places under the Armistice Agreement of 1949. In reality, however, the Jews were not allowed to visit the wall or any of the other sacred shrines. In Israel's war of independence, Jordan forcefully captured the old city and continued to occupy it for the next 19 years. Golda describes to the UJA Madison Square Garden audience the site when Israeli soldiers liberated East Jerusalem and the old city during the 67 war.
These paratroopers, in their paratroopers' uniform, quite a few of them were highly religious, with the tzitzis hanging out behind their jackets. Morning, their Sten guns put on the table with the tefillin, with the talasim, first kissing the stones of these walls. They wept, but it was not a wailing wall anymore. These were not Jews that came to the wall to wail and cry bitterly because they were not free, because they were not independent, because we have not yet come home. These were men who fought a bitter battle, who believed and had faith in the fact that this wall is a symbol for the future and in the future of independence and dignity for Israel. These men saw their comrades fall near them in battle, and here they were, due to their devotion, due to their sacrifice. There they stood again, in front of the Wailing Wall, praying, weeping, but not wailing in sorrow, but praying, offering a prayer of thanksgiving that here we are again as free Israelis in the city of Jerusalem.